My name is Shelley Milne, and I'd like to welcome you to my first podcast for Wilder Scotland. This morning, I was privileged to speak with Mr. Peter Smith, scientist, conservationist, and CEO of the Wildwood Trust, a Kent-based charitable organisation which has been instrumental in many captive breeding and wildlife reintroduction projects, including the conic horse, beaver, and wild boar. His passion for the subject is clearly evident, and I'd like to share with you his perspective on rewilding as he sheds light on some of the challenges that these projects face and provides deeper insight on the potential release of wild lynx in the UK.
Okay, Doc. My background is originally into science in genetic modelling and population of species going extinct. And I then moved on to working for a number of wildlife conservation organisations. Scottish Wildlife Trust was my first job, so I've got a Scottish link, as well as a Scottish grandfather. And I've always been interested in rewilding. Very, very early on, my ecological knowledge led me to see the flaws in many conservation schemes, because we don't need so much humans to make the complex ecology that's suited for our rare species. We need other animals through ecological processes, mostly large herbivores. But ecology is a complex beast and has got many complex relationships. And by removing them, we decrease our diversity across a whole range. And we can see that the removal of predators in Britain has caused generally the increase of some types of herbivores, or we've used it for farming. And this is the biggest problem we've got of our wildlife, is how man has changed ecology. And then we've tried in the wildlife conservation profession to emulate these practices by using people with bill hooks and chainsaws, and not very effective. That's why we're still seeing today the loss of wildlife of all types. So my background, many years ago, as I was into rewilding, and the first rewilding scheme I got involved with was beaver reintroduction at Hound Fen, and that was in 1998. Up until that point, talking about these concepts was almost heresy within, you know, many wildlife conservation organisations, to get conservation back and actually reverse the decline of wildlife in the UK. Now, since that time, I helped found with a chap called Ken West the Wildwood Trust, specifically to investigate and develop practical skills in rewilding. We've rewild a number of projects. We've got about 20 odd projects using wild horses, the conic pony. Okay. We've also done projects for reintroduction of water voles and dormice. And we've pushed for more beaver introductions, and we've developed a number of those over in Wales and elsewhere. So the general rewilding of land. Now, lynx, if we move to lynx, why are lynx such a good candidate for reintroduction? They are a top predator, and that means their ecological effects are complex, but many. And one of the things we need to do is reduce the grazing pressure of deer in many places across the UK, not just in Scotland, but mostly in Scotland. We also want to reduce the effect of sheep grazing, if we can, because doing both those things will allow the natural regeneration of upland habitats, have knock-on effects that save so many of our endangered species. If you want to save the wildcat, if you want to promote the recolonization of red squirrels to the UK, if you want to save the capercaillies, all these creatures evolved in a semi-wooded habitat, and that's what we've lost. So lynx are not so much killing the deer. will help spread their populations out and change their behaviours, which will allow the partial restoration of some areas for the trees to regrow in a more natural way, and for that Caledonian forest or other upland forests to retake hold, and that will provide the perfect habitat for some of our rarest and most endangered species. So that's why lynx are a very good candidate to reintroduce. Also, unlike wolves, lynx have never proven to be a danger to humans. They're too small. There's no records of lynx attacking humans, so that's not a problem. When you that's the basic underlying assumption, trying to restore the more natural ecological habitat, upland wooded habitat, which lynx would help. Wouldn't be the perfect. Ideally, I'd like to reintroduce wolves and bears too, and have a proper national park. Kick all the idiots who go blasting away with deer, because a lot of people don't realise is deer management is there to actually increase the numbers of deer, supplementary feeding, animal links, licks that give minerals, everything to increase the deer numbers. And we see across Europe and even across the world that game management practices actually increase the number of game species for a commercial reason. And this causes untold ecological damage. So we need to de-link that system, and lynx is a way of getting around some of these problems. But obviously it's hugely contentious. Not only do you have the issue of being scared, but you have the economic factors of, London bankers wanting to go and have a quick trip to shoot a deer that's right in front. You have to walk 10 miles to stalk one. Or you've got people who want to share game, shoot game, raid birds, or you have upland farmers who are subsidised to farm sheep. And we are attacking that root privilege that we are paying, giving tax advantages to these people. And deer hunting has a number of tax advantages in the way that you can own land and offset taxes. They can then use that land in a way that destroys a common property, which is wildlife. So we need to look. Lynx is a wonderful way of at least tackling some of those issues without having to look to the root cause of why we're losing so much wildlife in the UK. Mostly down to land ownership and land management practices and the taxation economic systems that funds the destruction of nature. That's what I'm more interested in. But lynx are a beautiful tool, in the easiest tool we can use in introducing a top predator to start addressing some of the ecological problems we have in the UK.
Do you think that, as well as having obviously an ecological benefit, there's an opportunity here for a sociological benefit as well? Because obviously there would need to be a sustained period of education in order to build public confidence in a project such as reinstating lynx. And by doing so, do you think it would help a psychological shift to maybe understand the natural world a bit better and maybe make people feel a bit more part of it rather than above it, if that makes sense?
Yes, I'm not a social scientist myself, so I don't claim any specialist knowledge. My specialist knowledge is definitely ecological and economic, in relationship to ecological. The sociological benefits, I can talk from personal sphere and what I see in my charity's work to educate people. I think having a link to nature is very important. I certainly have observed a huge sea change over the last 20 years of my career, where some of the thoughts I had on ecology and rewilding a long time ago when I was a student and a researcher were seen as heresy. People thought about them, or if they had, they thought it was so far out that it would never happen. But now, within the conservation community and people who support conservation, these are becoming much more common, and people are adopting a kind of understanding of the ecology that used to live and the role of nature conservation and what it can actually achieve by looking at these deeper issues of land use and complex ecological restoration. I've observed a sea change in the conservation community, which I think is wonderful. Now, with all avant-garde social movements, and I have looked at social movements, I have read a few books on social movements of the like, academic group, of the like of certain movements that have helped nature conservation. And from that, you can see that certainly there's a shifting way that it is reported in the media and people's perceptions. At our charity, we've now got 50,000 members, and many of them have learned a lot about nature conservation on a much deeper degree. You're also seeing a lot more journalists and stories that have much better ecological knowledge. The Scotsman this week had a story on beaver reintroduction that was actually well thought out. And when you saw reporting 10 years ago, it was appalling. I mean, the amount of stupidity, just inaccuracy, lack of knowledge was appalling. But now the reporting that we see in the media is much more akin to what is good ecological knowledge. So I think that's wonderful to watch that and watch the development of the rewilding movement. And I suppose to most people, they won't be concerned, but it's certainly a growing movement. And there's more people learning about rewilding and real, you know, scientific knowledge of ecological relationships between the land and different types of wildlife.
It's interesting you bring up the media coverage. One of the questions that I had, you know, anticipated to ask you was with regards to the media portrayal of larger predators, specifically things like wolves, bears, and lynx to an extent. Do you feel that it's portrayed fairly, or do you feel that there's still a sensational bias there that tends to creep in?
Oh, media live sensation. They're to sell newspapers or advertising online revenue now, and that's their role. They are an economic force to maximise people's interest, and a lot of people are going to be only interested in wildlife as a spectacle or a threat. And that's how they're going to view the media, and journalists will of course write articles to show that. But I certainly think there has been a change in the media of more conscious reporting with better ecological knowledge about large carnivores, mostly I think driven really by the European rewilding movement. We've seen wolves and bears and lynx move back to former ranges in places like France and Germany, and even wolves back to Holland. And this has become quite common, and they've had all these different sides of the media reporting on the stories. But I think that's feeding into how it's been reported in this country as well, that it's still seen, I mean, you know, if you read the UKIP manifesto, they called rewilding a madcap idea. And I think that level of stupidity, of ignorance, is always going to be in, you know, 30 to 40% of the population. They've got no connection to nature. They don't understand it. They've got nothing to do with it. They've got no idea of ecology, and they don't want to know, and they won't know. Nothing we can do will teach them. And obviously a large proportion of these people will want to vote UKIP. But for those people who want to understand the role of ecology and the real chances of the danger of wildlife, as I always say to people who come to Wildwood, if I take them in the wolf enclosure, and they'll say, you know, the risk to you today is not coming in the wolf enclosure. It's when you got out of the bath and you could have slipped up and cracked your skull open, mm-hmm. or your car journey to the trust. That's the real statistical risk. But because of human perceptions that are, you know, deeply withheld as well, evolutionary reasons, we are scared of wild animals. And that is an issue that is concerns both people and is exploited by media, who are only there to have, you know, effect of selling newspapers for stimulating people's fear and emotional response.
Okay. You mentioned the European rewilding introductions, which have been hugely successful, particularly in, as you said, the Netherlands and in Norway. I'm curious to hear your thoughts, if you have any, on the problems that Norway have had with lynx, specifically on the sheep depredations, which seem to be exponentially higher than anywhere else in Europe, but are still statistically very low. Do you have any thoughts on that? Are you aware of that at this stage?
Yes, I've read a few of the papers. It's quite obvious for those people who've looked into the problem of sheep in Norway is because of the way their sheep farming works, where they fence many of those sheep in winter times to graze within woodlands. This has a couple of problems. A, it actually decreases the biodiversity of woodlands because the sheep, although they're sheltering within the woodlands, are eating the understory out, which is not good. But also, that is the habitat of the lynx. The lynx is effectively a woodland predator. And where you have animal grazing within woodlands, that is the chief reason why lynx predate more sheep in Norway than anywhere else. It's just historic farming practices and the climate of Norway that creates it. It wouldn't in Britain unless we decided, or some landowners, in a sort of semi-rewilded habitat with more trees, that we were going to which was a common practice in Britain on common land to have grazing within woodlands. Woodland grazing was a common practice if we go back 500 years or more.
I think it is a valid point to look at the past history of how we used to manage sheep, because clearly shepherding practice and the sort of more old-fashioned ways of protecting your flock have long since been abandoned. Do you think that maybe there are opportunities in agriculture for potentially higher employment levels and maybe more economic benefit to them should the project go ahead in terms of employment if they have to return to some of these old school methods of managing their flocks?
I don't know if old school is the way humans develop. There are our current economic system, the way we have land ownership, the way we have subsidies for farming, the way we have tax allowances for farming, the way we tax farming, means that we're always going to have less people and more inputs, more bigger machines, land used inefficiently, used efficiently per person in the industry, but used very inefficiently actually per acre. And that's what we've developed in this country. We've developed a farming system with very few people, but with a lot of inputs, a lot of capital employed that is very inefficient just because of the tax structure we have. Whether rewilding is going to solve that, as I'm not too sure. I mean, certainly having some animals running around will have to change certain upland sheep practices. But let's face it, we've only got upland sheep farming because of the tax. If we removed the subsidies and take away some of the tax benefits, there wouldn't be any upland sheep farming. We are paying people to farm sheep to destroy wildlife. The taxpayer is subsidizing landowners to a massive tune, purely to destroy wildlife for no economic advantage, and certainly not giving us food security, because the amount of food calories it's delivering to Britain is minuscule, it's tiny as a percentage. So it's rubbish. We shouldn't be doing it. Subsidising people to live as farmers is a very poor choice for what we should do as a government. That should be. And those individuals, there would be more economic opportunities for employment and better quality employment if we moved to having uplands out of intensive farming and into more recreational-based activities. Certainly, I think. But the trouble is who benefits? It always is who benefits. You've got one group of people, the landowners, the uplands with uplands. You're never going to let that go because they're not the people who's going to get employed in a rewilded habitat. That's going to be younger people. That's going to be people with fresh ideas and drive and entrepreneurial zeal will create the employment opportunity. opportunities. Not the landowners who sit on their bums and just get their rent from the farmers, because most of these places, actually, the farmers aren't the landowner, and get their subsidies for doing not a lot of work. And that's the problem I think we face. Rewilding will do that to some extent, but I always think the real challenge for rewilding is an economic one, where we take away the unearned revenue of landowners who are just sitting there doing nothing to get their money, and we start making sure that farmers, genuine farmers who work the land, receive more of their work, so they get a higher return on their labour. We also have to tax the externalities of the inputs. So the externalities are, you know, the pollution, the chemicals, that how it's made. So we rebalance and we take taxes off of people's labour so they can get a higher return on that labour. That's rewilding in an economic sense. But having links back will do that to some extent, because it will cause more problems to upland farmers, and that will hopefully push some more to look at other uses of their land that is more rewilded and more based on people enjoying nature and not on the uneconomic production of wool and sheep meat.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. To a certain extent, I suppose it could be argued that the farmers have perhaps had it a bit too easy the last few years because of the subsidies and because of the government help available to them.
We have to make the distinction between landowners and farmers. That is where it all goes wrong, where you put a poor upland farmer up there who's a tenant farmer and say his life's hard. Well, his life's hard whether you have rewilding or not, because he has to pay his rent to his landlord. It is the landlords that are the real villain in this piece, not the farmer. And if a farmer is a landowner, you have to distinguish between that which he works to produce and that which he is a landowner.
Okay, that's a very interesting distinction, and definitely one that should be made. I agree with that. From an economic perspective then, do you think that on balance there's an opportunity for things like ecotourism to profit the country in a stronger way than perhaps agriculture is at this stage, or certainly within the areas that will be affected?
Yes. Obviously, 40% of the UK is not economic to farm, and we shouldn't be doing it. We don't farm it. And of that 40%, a lot of it is badly used. It's inefficiently used. It's not bringing in revenue to the country as such, and that revenue is concentrated in inefficient hands. You know, a lot of it won't even hit the Britain, it'll disappear or whatever. So what we want to use is the land as most efficiently. Now, ecotourism is one thing, but that's not the way to look at the economic. That is one economic benefit, but it is one, probably less than 10% of the true economic benefit of rewilding. If we look, if you study economics deeply, you will find that the economic benefits of rewilding for the average person in the UK will be much higher in things like flood prevention and water management, whereby having that and is a store of water, of releasing that water more slowly. Also, people who live in those areas, their property values increase. So if you actually want to measure what the true economic benefit, because the rule that you're not allowed to talk about in economic circles today is Ricardo's Law, whereby the economic activity always ends up in the value of the land, or the rental value of the land. And therefore, all the benefits of having a nicer place, of having better water treatment, and even in the far distant future of carbon capture and storage in the peaty soils of uplands, all accrue to land, whether mostly in the city, if it's got a flooding risk, or reduce when you reduce your bills for water purification, your rents and house prices go up. So those are the true benefits, and that probably accounts for 90% of the economic benefit of the UK of having rewilded uplands. But ecotourism will increase and will be important, but you've got to see it in the context of the true overall economic benefits that would be really derived by rewild.
Yeah.
I thought about this a lot for a long time.
Yeah, it's a lot to process. You're full of information. I'm delighted. It's a fascinating perspective because most people want to talk specifically about individual animals or on a very niche focused basis. It's nice to see a sort of very broad overview from that perspective because it's fascinating. Do you think, what then, with all of that in mind, I know that you do some consultancy for various government departments and some NGOs, what do you think the likelihood of some of these projects going ahead actually is? I mean, I know we already have the beavers, but the lynx are somewhat more contentious and wolves, again, are a step further removed from that. What's your thoughts on the likelihood of these projects?
Well, I spent a lot of time in political campaigning. That was my job at Scottish Wildlife Trust 20 years ago, and trying to push for the first beaver reintroduction license at Ham Fenny, that was Fenny, and the political shenanigans that went on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And now and again, you do get a chance of persuading a government minister to do these things. The chance of getting a reintroduction that the Lynx Trust UK is asking for is probably small. That's because of two main factors. One is that a lot of people, the government decision makers, will not allow it because they'll be lobbied against. The other one is actually between competition within wildlife organisations in Scotland who have got sharp elbows and they want to be seen as the people do this. So I always say you'll get one organisation that say, I'm against reintroductions, until of course they come out with their own programme for reintroduction. So I think the Lynx Trust UK have got a battle with this one. But if they get it, great, then I'd support it. It has to be done right. I certainly don't believe that you have to get agreement from everybody before you start something. I think that's agreement in public opinion, if we look in what little sociology I know, is endogenous in nature. And that means you do something and then people will get used to it and think about it. You don't get them to agree before you do it. And that's certainly been what happened really with the beavers. Although there were public surveys, most people were just not aware of the real issues. And as things happen, people will educate themselves if they're affected by it and stuff like that. You know, having popular public opinion is not the best judge of policy always, because life's complicated and only a few people understand the issues. So you do need expert advice and ministerial approval. I think the rewilding movement will hopefully grow and there will be more and more pressure. When I started in this business 20 years ago, even mentioning beaver reintroduction was a heresy that, you know, you could lose your job. I know somebody in Natural England who lost their job over reintroduction because it upset some people, and the next reorganisation, they were elbowed out, and directly because of that. So this battle will rage on for many years, but I think as we as a whole society understand more about the history of our ecology, more of us become more knowledgeable about ecology, the pressures will build and it will happen. But it might take a bit more time for the lynx reintroduction and the wolf reintroduction. And eventually, hopefully in 50 or 100 years' time, we shall have a national park in Scotland big enough to have bears once again.
That would be absolutely amazing. I agree with you on that. I think it would be a completely different country if that was the case, but I have to say that based on some of the interviews and things I've had, I would agree with you that the political and sociological climate's possibly not quite there yet. Do you think that, you know, you've talked a lot about the lobbying. I had certainly considered the political implications and the objections that would come from various government departments. Do you think that the conservation movement as a whole potentially is stamping on its own agendas by infighting? Do you see that being a problem with conservation groups because they're not united?
When you get as old and cynical as I am, you will realise that competition is always there. It is just a force. It's a force of nature, and it will always happen in different groups that they have to compete for funds and influence. It's huge to be competitive within different conservation groups. Trying to find agreement is very hard. It can be found. There's going to be a paper released in a few weeks from a group of nearly all the major Scottish conservation organisations on beavers. Common cause is found. But this is after the effect. You know, beavers have already happened in Scotland. It's probably nobody's going to reverse it without a huge uproar. And that's what we see with the Tay beavers. You know, there's probably 300 beavers on the Tay now. The chances of them removing them are very small. And the public outcry in any attempt to remove them would be huge. And so I often look at conservation organisations and government organisations almost trying to rationalise what is already happening. So I see rewilding and reintroductions as a movement within the hearts and minds of lots of people who work in these organisations and departments, who push for it. And these organisations will rationalise and try to make out that it's them who are doing it and give it legal, fictional clothing when it happens. And certainly when it comes to lynx reintroduction, you'll probably see a movement very similar to what happens with beaver reintroduction, where there will be movements to do it illegally and movements to do it legally, and the pressure will kind of fuzz its way through without this magical piece of paper that comes from from Scottish Natural Heritage or some kind of long consultation process that will issue a license. It will be forced, and that might take 20 years. It would be wonderful if I was wrong and that some far-sighted politician who was presented with this decision by SNH from a license application actually showed some mettle and made that decision.
Scottish National Heritage actually popped up in the press just last week with a rather controversial story about a wildcat issue, because obviously there's the wildcat haven over in is it Argyll that they're based in, and for years they've been looking at the preservation of the wildcat, and Scottish National Heritage last week popped up doing some sort of hybrid reintegration program. Did you see that?
I did. I saw the controversy of the idea of trying to make a captive bred population couple of weeks ago, but not where there seems to be a lot of tensions between the wildcat haven and other conservationists at the moment, and that might come out of that. Whether hybrids are what level of problem they present?
Yeah. Okay, it's just interesting because obviously we do seem to have quite a, I don't know if I'd use the word combustible, environment in conservation in Scotland at the moment, because there's so many projects happening all at the same time and so many people pushing for future projects. One of the farmers that I interviewed a few weeks ago suggested that every time something gets protected or reintroduced, there's then the obvious problem of you then create a further imbalance over time because they're looked after in a specific way, and then you have to go back through another cycle where often there then has to be a cull or some sort of management process put in behind it. Do you think that is true, or do you think that's just a potential perspective that the farming community have developed?
Well, I think the farming community are like all humans, want money for doing not much work, and the ability to destroy nature is a government-granted license to farm. They will exploit it as much as they can for their own benefit to make as much money with doing as little work as possible. I know that's uncharitable, but we all do it, I myself included. We all want to achieve our objectives with our work. Licensing and government regulations is a very inefficient method of wildlife. What wildlife needs is land, and it needs the right type of land with the right type of structure of wildlife. I would much rather save wildlife by rewilding, having a nature grid, corridors that was not doing proper population models, land management, a proper spatial planning system, far better than saying this species is protected. Although we do want to stop people hunting and killing certain animals if it damages the ecological mix. And then who decides that ecological mix? And that's where I think SNH has failed the Scottish people, in that their policies are pretending to control nature by having these rules and regulations, but not actually looking at the end result of what they are. And I wish SNH would actually take more ownership of the end result of Scottish biodiversity and less on polishing the paper clips and oiling the staplers and making the appearance as though they are think nature conservation in Scotland. And that's the problem with all wildlife departments around the world. Some are much better. The Nordic countries, far superior. Canada, wonderful, much better public bodies regulating and looking into wildlife protection. And I think SNH should look at those and develop some better skills in actually how you, instead of writing bits of paper that seem to help.
That's an interesting point. Do you think then that from a government perspective there is a lot more that could be done to protect the existing environment we have and perhaps enable future reintroductions in an easier manner? Or do you think that that's just going to become more bureaucratic and more complex as time goes on?
Well, very much how I answered the last question is I think I dislike too much bureaucracy, but you need bureaucracy. And what I'd like to see in SNH is more scientists and less bureaucrats, because many of the SNH people are just bureaucrats. They're looking at how they climb the greasy pole of the civil service, and not how they actually affect. And it's almost like the senior management at both English Nature and Natural England want to get rid of all of the good specialists, people who actually understand ecology, and just have pen pushers in their place. I really, really despair of many government institutions. Same with housing policy or any other policy, even defence. You know, you can look at it. We have people who are risk averse, not achieving objectives. And I think I'd like to change our way of conducting nature conservation to having objectives that are objective, real objectives, not spurious bureaucratic objectives, if we are going to save wildlife. And if we are going to save wildlife, and if we are going to improve the lives of people in this country, we're going to have to tackle the land question, because the land question is why wildlife's dying out. The land question's why we have such terrible productivity. We can't compete on the world stage in industry, and it's all down to the monopoly of land being so expensive and concentrated in few hands and intertwined with our banking and financial systems. We need to make a free market in land, and have land that is no use for anybody economically go back to nature. That's how I think we'll solve the problem. But whether that'll happen, people have tried for many, many generations to free the land from monopoly control, and they haven't gotten very far.
Going back to the links, because that is all very interesting, and thank you so much for your input on that, because it is fascinating to hear the frustrations of working in that sector. But going back to the links just for a second, if the project was to go ahead, if all the red tape is got through and public opinion defends it and the project is deemed viable and links are released, what in the event of it not being successful, if there's a major backlash, say that, you know, there is a huge implication for the agricultural community or there are issues for land users or landowners in other ways that the results in a backlash. What then would happen? What would happen in the event of an unsuccessful release?
I should imagine if you release something that the whole of society is determined to stop, you'd shoot them. So it wouldn't be that hard. Links are modern I mean, the trouble is there's not many people who actually know how to shoot. Most of the people shoot here nowadays have got no skills. But it would be very easy to get some people with night vision gear to go and shoot the lynx. I mean, it wouldn't be that hard. They live in small numbers. You'd set up trail cams, you'd monitor where they are, you'd know roughly where they are, and you'd pay professional hunters to get rid of them. So I don't see that as a society's problems. It's not going to cost a lot of money like it does with much smaller invasive species that we have that have got a real economic impact. So I don't see an exit strategy would be very simple and not cost a lot. In the case of lynx or wolves, it wouldn't be a problem.
So in talking of cost, you know, is there any indication, I haven't been able to find an indication anywhere yet, of what the cost of this sort of reintroduction would be to bring back a big cat in the UK? Do you have any idea of what sort of cost they're talking about?
Yes, I've obviously put some business models together because obviously Wildwood, our charity, is dedicated to supporting rewilding objectives, and we would probably offer our services free of charge to anybody who got a license. So and we've done projects like this with beavers and other things, and we import lots of animals. Just imported some bears before Christmas.
I saw that.
So the costs, and we did it with the beavers. So the costs, we would have to locate and capture wild lynx, because you'd want to use captive red lynx, you want wild lynx. And so the costs would depend. Normally we get these animals free from a group that's already been funded by the government. So you'd look at Germany or other Eastern European countries that had lynx populations that were over a level that they were happy with. If you had to pay for them to be caught in those countries, that could cost a bit of money. But normally we've managed to do it without incurring costs or just contributing a small amount to that cost. Then the transport to this country. Now, you'd probably want to reintroduce 30 to 100 lynx for genetics. Some of those would die. But a lot of people wouldn't want that. So I doubt we'd actually end up more importing and quarantining more than, say, 30 lynx, and that would be over a number of years. It wouldn't be one hit. We could easily make the quarantine facilities for the quarantine process here at Wildwood. Probably capital costs less than £5,000. Costs to us of doing it, I don't know, maybe £20,000 for staff. Importation costs probably about £5,000 for every year for transporting the animals, £5,000 to £10,000. And then transport and release costs, well, there's no infrastructure. You're just going to take them up in the van and shove them out. You'd obviously want monitoring and other costs. There's some veterinary costs. So I reckon we could probably do the whole thing at a bargain basement price of £150,000, which I'm sure our members and supporters of Wildwood Trust would happily pay for. So it wouldn't cost the taxpayer a penny.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that, I mean, obviously we've had quite a successful record recently of most of the reintroductions that have come back have been fairly successful, especially in Scotland. You know, the white-tailed eagles have done well, the beavers have done well, the red squirrels are bouncing back. You know, there are significant signs of improvement, but then you have more questionable ones such as the capercaillie, which we've been battling with for years, and the numbers are still decreasing rapidly, and there's been a huge cost implication for that. So I think people, a lot of the arguments that are coming from protagonists, if you like, seem to be about the actual cost benefit of doing something like this. So it's interesting to be able to put a figure on it that'll be...
Well, the costs you're talking about are interesting, and it refers to the economics I talked about before. And this is why is the capercaillie costing so much money? And that's due to it's costing us as humans a lot of effort and time. When you get something like a white-tailed eagle or a beaver release, the costs are virtually nothing because the animals get on with it themselves. It's the humans monitoring and any form of mitigation. With capercaillie, you're talking about a really complex where it's almost like you're having to fight against other land uses all the time, deer fencings, other things. You're paying, and a lot of that cost is actually paying a rent to landowners for the use of the land. So I see the biggest cost in any conservation reintroduction is if our society says, well, we're going to leave landowners as they are, we're going to subsidize them, and we're going to pay them a rent to have their land in a favorable condition for wildlife, and we're not going to allow a proper rewilded ecosystem. We're actually going to have to pay human beings to recreate through human labor that ecological system with chainsaws or what have you. And that's why rewilding is such a wonderful concept, because you get nature for bugger all cash. You save the taxpayer a fortune and you get all the benefits. And it economically works. You know, even for the benefits, the few benefits of mostly water management and people's enjoyment that are expressed mostly in the land market, that it pays for itself. Nature will pay for its own way. We just have to stop messing with it so much.
So based on everything you've said this morning, it seems that the greatest challenge to not just rewilding, but to conservation efforts across Scotland seems to lie in the hands of the landowners. Is that correct?
Yes, in land reform. And if you look at the work of Andy Whiteman and others, is excellent in this regard, is the key to Scotland. Scotland's biggest problem was the Highland clearances, the land ownership system, when the Commons was taken away ruthlessly and a few people got to economically exploit for mostly sheep farm. And you're still dealing with those problems today. The most hideously unequal land ownership probably in the world, of any major democracy in the world. And that's one of the reasons Scotland's got such poor wildlife, when the land's not actually worth much or use. It's due to it's a toy for rich men to play with. It is not a proper ecosystem. Or we're still subsidising too much sheep farm. And we've got to get out of that. Scotland needs to have a democratic system of land ownership. I'm not advocating land reform where you steal land from owners, but by changing the taxation structure and making people pay a tax based on the value of their land and having to pay for the damage and the inputs they create to ecology, you will rebalance the economy where land will flow from the hands of the very few who abuse it uneconomically into the hands of people who can use it. And if nobody can use it in an economically just fashion, then it should be returned to wildlife. I've given you my sermon.
You have, and that was excellent. Thank you so much for your time. I do really appreciate that. That was absolutely fascinating, and you've certainly given me an awful lot of food for thought. Before we finish, I know that you're doing a bit of fundraising for the bears that you rescued from Bulgaria. Was it Bulgaria?
Yes. We're just about to release them. I've just signed a contract for $50,000 to build them a beautiful pond, a swimming pool. That's all jolly good fun, and you'll be able to watch it on the BBC One show, because they're going to film us releasing them to the out of quarantine. And they came over to Bulgaria when I went to pick them up before Christmas. All jolly good fun.
So there we have it. That was Peter Smith from the Wildwood Trust talking extensively about the economic and ecological benefits of these projects. To find out more about the Wildwood Trust, please do visit their website, which is www.wildwoodtrust.org.